So welcome, everyone, as always, to our FOMC panel. There are a lot of things I need to touch on today, so I'm excited to get our panelists' takes on recent data and how things are looking moving forward. And as I kind of go through introductions here today, please feel free to plug anything you've got coming out on the horizon or recently written. Love to share that with folks. So to start us off, we want to welcome back Joseph Wang, our go-to Fed guy. As many of you guys know, and we plug it every time, he headed the trading at the Fed's open markets desk, has an introductory book on central banking called Central Banking 101 that is a must read, and he's the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for inviting me. This is the best FOMC spaces. I'm glad to be here. I know I always learn a lot when I'm here. It's great to see Bob and Alas Bear again, and to welcome my friend Martin here. Martin's super sharp. I've met Martin before, and I've done a few podcasts with him. Really looking forward to what he has to say.
As am I, and with that beautifully perfect segue, we do have Martin Pelletier here. Martin is the senior portfolio manager at Wellington Altus Private Counsel. With over 20 years of investment industry experience, he also co-manages the firm's risk managed balance. I'm excited to have his experienced insight in today's macro panel, and I know we'll learn a lot. Welcome, Martin.
You betcha. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be among such profound individuals who really have a good understanding of the big picture macro. And I'm hoping that maybe I can add a few things on the micro and how to make some money or protect portfolios in this kind of environment.
Really excited to have you here, Martin. Thanks for joining us today. Next, we've got the last bear standing, a longstanding friend of the spaces. Last Bear is an expert on markets where he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that Substack, you should go do that now. You'll learn a lot. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, as always, for happening. I apologize in advance. I think I have some lingering COVID still hanging over, but I'll try to make it through for the spaces. Looking forward to it.
I'm sorry to hear that, but for what it's worth, you sound fabulous. Next, we've got Bob Elliott, another friend of the spaces. Bob is the CIO at Unlimited Fund, former IC at Bridgewater, and the all-time leader in useful Twitter threads during a banking crisis. He's also a friend of these spaces, and I want to give Bob a warm welcome back. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks so much for having me. Definitely share with the sentiment that this is the best FOMC spaces. Love hanging out with y'all and this panel every 6 weeks or so. And welcome to Martin. Great to get him to join us as well. I'm excited for this.
As am I. But before we get started, I want to paint a quick macro overview picture since our last FOMC panel. In March, jobs were up 303,000 workers. The consumer price index climbed 3.5% year over year in March, and inflation has been remaining a bit more sticky than perhaps many people expected. Median home prices continue to rise while mortgage rates remain around their highs, and the talks of rate cuts have shifted from many calling for up to 6 cuts, now down to the possibility of no cuts at all, with some even suspecting a likelihood of more hikes. Gold has again hit new all-time highs, while oil prices teeter around new lows since March. We're May now. So kind of as a first off lead to, I would like to get everybody's thoughts on the Treasury buyback since it's a little more recent. And I want to just kind of kick it around the panel to open us off. Let's start with Bob here.
This is going to be a bit of an uninteresting take, but I think it probably doesn't matter really much at all. What matters is that there is, $1.1 trillion of gross issuance, in the second quarter and in the third quarter, and huge deficits that need to be funded. And it's the sort of thing that, in any one day, any one auction, can go well or poorly based upon what's happening in the market. But you essentially have a huge seller of duration in the market that every day is coming in and selling duration, and every day needs somebody to figure out, needs somebody to buy that duration And the question is, who can they get and at what price can they get that demand? And so I likened that sort of overall story to water drip torture earlier today. And I think that's probably, you know, probably what we're going to see for the next 5 months, it looks like. So that's, I think that's a bigger story than a few buybacks here or there.
Fair enough. Does anyone agree, disagree, anything to add? Feel free to chime in.
Yeah, I totally agree with Bob. And just for some perspective, the size of the Treasury buybacks is quite small. So the Treasury is going to do two types of buyback programs. One is for market liquidity. And what they're going to do is they're going to issue more on the runs and use the money to buy some off the runs, basically a debt swap to improve the liquidity of the market. And the other type of buyback they're going to do is just for liquidity management. For example, the Treasury, like any other business, has lots of ebbs and flows in their cash flow. For example, during April, they receive lots of tax receipts. They get a lot of extra cash. Under this new liquidity part of the buyback program, they can spend some of that cash and buy back some debt, save the public some interest costs. But the size of these programs, about $100 billion each. And when you're looking at that in reference to the size of the Treasury market, it's really small. And like Bob mentioned, we're issuing, you know, trillions of net issuance. This stuff is not going to make that big of a difference. But I also note, though, that the way that the government usually does things is that they start small. And what at first is a temporary program eventually becomes something that lives forever, kind of like the reverse repo facility. And so we could totally see this program grow and become more prominent in the coming years. But today, I think it's not going to move the needle one way or another.
Thank you, Joseph. Martin or Last Bear, anything to add?
Yeah, I think the bigger picture, I mean, we can get lost in the nuances of Fed policy and what's happening, but the bigger picture is, and I tend to be a little bit more right-brained in looking at the whole paradigm of what's transpiring. And it's not just in just the Fed, but globally as well. You have governments that are running these deficits that are the biggest that we've seen, as if it's a financial crisis in the U.S. anyway. It's like they're running a size of deficit equivalent to 2008 financial crisis. So they didn't taper down their spending despite the economic recovery post the shutdowns. And so there's a lot of limitations as to what they can do in regards to issuing an amount and size of debt that they have to issue to finance these large deficits. And so there are some constraints in regards to currency. Now, in Canada, we don't have the benefit of having the gold standard U.S. dollar. And so we're really somewhat in a pickle. But even the U.S., for example, are looking towards ways of financing these deficits outside of issuing even more debt to cover the interest costs, and that's taxation. And so, you know, the central banks are I don't envy whoever's working. I mean, if you're working at a central bank, when you have governments that are doing the other side of that trade, and so it's a really tough situation.
Thank you, Martin. So Martin added quite a bit. Does anyone have any comments to the additions that Martin made? Maybe Last Bear.
Yeah, I guess I kind of agree with the general theme that the past three guys have mentioned, but it's not, I don't view it as being a huge deal. It is another lever that the Treasury will have to sort of influence prices to some marginal extent, but obviously it doesn't change the fact that on balance and on net, they are a massive issuer of debt. And if they're buying back some amount, whether that's for liquidity purposes or whether that's to smooth TGA fluctuations in the short term around tax season, it doesn't change the broader picture, which is that the net issuance is quite large, and that's based on deficits plus obviously interest expense.
Thank you, Last Bear. So I do want to kind of dive in kind of right up to the topic of hand here. And we can always double back to Treasury if anybody has any extra comments there as well. But Joseph, I want to have you start us off here. You tweeted earlier this month that the markets regarded the Fed as too hawkish. And I mean, earlier this year, you know, things were seemingly pricing in up to 7 rate cuts. And in just a few months, that's shifted down to one, now zero, and some are even projecting another rate hike. You'd mentioned in the past that the December dot plots aligned with the concept of three rate cuts. What are you seeing here now, Joseph? And do you still expect those three rate cuts this year, as you'd mentioned?
So I think you're making a really good point that the market is very volatile when it comes to pricing the expectation of Fed policy. Another way to think about this is the market is just not very good at anticipating what the Fed is going to do. At the end of December, the Fed was guiding towards three cuts. Sometime in early January, the market was pricing in as many as seven. And today we're pricing in maybe one cut, a little bit more than one cut. So I think it's helpful to level set a little bit to see how we got to where we are today. So in December, we had already had 6 months of core PCE at 2.0%. So the Fed's inflation target was basically bang on, and the Fed was feeling more comfortable. And that led Chair Powell at December to, you know, basically to welcome the market to price in some rate cuts. Now, in January and February, we had inflation data that was a bit hotter than expected. In March, when Chair Powell was asked about this, he basically shrugged and said that that's basically seasonal stuff, right? Except that when March, we got another higher than expected inflation print. And at that time, it seems like the Fed changed the tune. Chair Powell, when he was chatting with Governor Tiff Macklem of Canada, he made a point to say that he wasn't happy with progress on inflation. And he's telling the market that he's going to hold rates higher for longer. And since that pivot, and they've had many pivots, we're back to the market pricing in maybe just one cut. And I think right now we're probably at peak hawkishness. The way that I'm looking at this, and I disagree with the market, I think there's pricing not enough cuts, is that the Fed so far has been on easy mode. So the Fed has two mandates, full employment and price stability. Employment has been doing really well for the past few years, so they've really just been a one-mandate bank. But I think we're at the cusp here where we have enough indicators that the labor market seems to be moderating a bit. If you look at PMI surveys, you can see that there's a lot more commentary that the labor market demand is moderating. If you look at Atlanta Fed wage tracker, you can see that wages have gone down a lot. If you if you look at today's JOLTS reports, you can see the labor market moderating as well. So I think we're heading towards a world where that labor mandate, that employment mandate, is going to play a bit more of a role, and that's going to limit the amount of hawkishness the Fed can do. And also, if you think of it from the Fed's perspective, if you have core PCE at 2.7%, which is where we are now, that's not that far from your target. I'm not sure it makes sense to have interest rates at 5.5% where we are today. Fed speakers continue to perceive the world through the lens of a neutral interest rate that's quite low. And so they continue to think that they're very, very restrictive. So I think right now, in my personal view, is that we are at peak hawkishness, and the market is probably going to be just one employment report away from just going back to three cuts or maybe more.
Oh, there we go. Fought with my mic for a second. Thank you, Joseph. Now, a lot to dissect there, I think. So I'm curious to the rest of the panel. Do you agree with that sentiment of the market reaching peak hawkishness here? And in respect to that possibility of them raising their expectations back to those three cuts, let's go Bob, then Martin.
Yeah, well, I think the main takeaway from what Joseph was just saying, the most important takeaway, and I think it was a good description of sort of the path we've gotten to this point, is that what matters is the data. And I think a lot of folks there was a reason why Chairman Powell indicated the possibility of a pivot late last year. And the reason why he did is because the data was consistent with that shift in policy. And that's very important, because what that means, you know, a lot of people talk about, is it politics? Is it, you know, some other influence going on in terms of their behavior, some theoretical neutral rate? Is it, you know, all of these different possible ideas? And the reality is the data drives the decision making. The shift in the data has created the shift in the decision making. And so when you look at what is likely to transpire, the question is not, what the Fed thinks will happen, because who knows, because they're not very good at predicting anything. And it's not, let's call it external influences. It's what is going to happen with the data over the course of the next 3 to 6 months that will determine how they respond. And so you have to get ahead of the data in terms of understanding what's likely to transpire in order to understand how they're going to behave. And so, my thought would be a bit, that we're going to have a bit more in terms of inflationary pressures and not great. Inflation data that's not going to be at the Fed's mandate or give them sufficient confidence, in the near future. And so they're probably, not going to cut, they're probably not going to cut 3 or 4 times through the end of the year. Reasonable people can disagree about that. But what I would say is that connecting to what Joseph was highlighting in terms of sort of this quote peak hawkishness, I think it's a really important point, because from the market pricing perspective, the easy money has been made on saying that, on betting that the Fed will not be as easy as was expected at the beginning of the year. Like, whether they cut 1 or 0 times, like, who knows? The odds that they hike, I think, are probably, nice talking points on Bloomberg to kind of gin up, clicks and engagement. But it's not really a likely path that they're going to take, given the pressures that exist on the data. It's much more likely that, inflation is a little too high relative to what they'd like. And so what that leaves you is, what's priced in is about 1 cut through the end of the year. That doesn't seem particularly, doesn't seem that exciting in terms of a trade to say that, it's going to go from 1 to 0. If anything, probably the skew favors the opposite direction, where, the possibility, particularly if the long end continues to see this pressure, the possibility of the Fed, cuts more, maybe not over the course of the next 3 or 6 months, but over the course of the next 15 or 18 months, that seems not priced in. And so, favors holding 2s given the pricing relative, particularly relative to the long end.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So I agree with everything that Bob just said, but with the exception of human emotion. And if you take a look at, there's a really good a talk by a fellow by name Tom Morgan, and I highly recommend it, and I can share that on my X post down the road. But shows how we're very left brain orientated, and as a society, we've really in the last couple of years gone all in on being left brain, very analytical. And the problem is that you get choice overload, and there's so many data points that we're getting bombarded with, and trying to determine that said data point, and then I'm right and you're wrong, and looking at the data. And so as a result, we have those biases. And so what I mean by that is, if emotion plays a huge part in driving markets, and it'll drive emotion definitely has a part in driving fiscal and monetary policy. So when I look at this where we are right now, and I say the way I look at it is, I think is, as long as rate hikes are viewed as a non-zero probability event, the Fed won't cut. And I would say the same thing as long as rate cuts aren't viewed back then as a non-zero probability event, the Fed won't hike back then. And so I think we have to take a step back and say, okay, where are we in that safety of that crowd? Because everybody got it wrong at the beginning of the year. Not a single bank on Wall Street was close to making a forecast of just 1 rate cut this year. And everybody was expecting, 7 cuts. And UBS came out saying, we're going to see rate reductions at 2.5%, 10 cuts equivalent. So we got it wrong. And so many smart people got it wrong. So I think it's very helpful to take a look at the data 100%, but also take a step back and say, okay, maybe there's something I'm missing here. and what's going to drive the Fed to make a decision, and how is that going to trickle through into what we're doing from an investment standpoint?
Thank you, Martin. Last spare, do you have anything to add to that before we move along?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, so I think it was maybe 2 months ago or at the early part of this year, I made some of the same arguments that that Joseph just laid out around the labor market, and Bob very politely said that he disagreed with that. And honestly, I think Bob was more right than I was at the time, given the data that we saw there that we've seen recently. So obviously there's JOLTS data that came out this week, but there's also ADP data this morning that showed a very strong labor, broad-based labor growth. And the other interesting thing about the ADP data is that job switchers, so they have pay insights data as well. So job switchers, people who change jobs, the rate of wage growth that they're seeing in changing jobs is now moving back up again and has been since the start of the year as well, which may indicate that employers are actually starting to be, you know, after 2 years of sort of easing pressure in the wage market, might be starting to see some tension come back and normalization come back into that market after sort of, I would say, a 2 year slowdown from a very, very stretched position. And so combined with all the other sort of inflationary data, whether that be commodity pressures, you know, gasoline prices, just broader core PCE services type indications that have happened over the past couple months, I think it is a legitimate concern that the Fed has around, you know, the ongoing path of inflation going forward. And so I don't think that, I mean, I'm certainly not calling for hikes, but I think the plurality of the data as I see it today is certainly supportive of maintaining the current status quo, at least on rates, until we see that inflection go the other way.
Thanks, Lesper. And that actually sets me up for a point that I wanted to hammer into today as well regarding jobs in relation with rate cuts. So Joseph, I'm going to pick on you again here to start us off on this train of thought. On the job situation, you wrote in one of your newsletter pieces that the Fed is shifting its stance on the need to dampen wage growth, and now instead suggests that strong employment can, as you put it, be compatible with cutting rates. This seems to be pretty much a full 180-degree turn from the narrative of the last several years on the topic. And so, Joseph, could you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think we could rewind, let's say, a couple years ago, back to the Jackson Hole speech, where Chair Powell basically went on stage. He told everyone there would be some pain, short speech, and then he sat back down. At that time, the Fed's thinking was basically traditional economist thinking, through looking at the world through the lens of the Phillips curve. They were thinking that, well, we got inflation really high. A lot of it is wage driven. So the way that we could get inflation under control is to raise interest rates, slow the economy down, increase the unemployment rate, and through that, lower wage growth. And so in that framework, what she really wanted to see to get the Fed to cut rates would be for the unemployment rate to rise, or another way to say that is to have weak jobs growth. But the strange thing that happened afterwards is that month after month, we've had very strong job growth. And recently, it seems like the monthly NFP numbers have actually accelerated. Now, if you're looking at this from a traditional perspective, you could say that, my gosh, demand is accelerating, monetary policy is not working, we got to hike some more. Now, I think that was how the Fed initially thought of it. But I think they're changing their mind because they're realizing that this increase in job growth, which is happening in line with a moderating wage growth, is not due to strong demand, it's due to increase in supply. So one of the key variables that have shifted in the US is over the past few years, we've just had tremendous, tremendous amounts of immigration. Now, no one knows for sure how many millions of people have entered the country because a lot of it is illegal. But the Congressional Budget Office is suggesting that it's quite a large number. And this changes a lot of things. This, one of the things it does change when it comes to monetary policy is that we can have strong employment prints and we can also have moderating wages, not so much because the economy is overheating, but simply because we have a lot more of an increase in the supply of labor. And I would also note, just following up on what you were just speaking about. So this is continuing. We still have millions of people entering the labor force here. And that's going to put upward pressure on the unemployment rate. So eventually, that's another contributor that's going to, I think, make the Fed's other mandate, full employment, come into play, maybe sooner than expected.
Thank you, Joseph. And Bob, I'm going to kick it over to you next here, because you also commented earlier this month on labor, saying that since the labor market remains tight and in line with a, quote, decent GDP report, you concluded that no recession. Can you walk us through that? And then I'd be interested to kick both of your responses around the whole panel again.
Well, I think what Joseph's highlighting about the significant increase in labor supply as a function of immigration is a critically important part of the story. You know, we've benefited in aggregate from a significant amount of labor supply over the course of the last, let's say, 18 months, as the unemployment rate has remained flat and overall demand has been pretty strong, in part because participation rose considerably, particularly from prime age women, and to some extent men, but prime age women coming into the labor force was a very important part of it, and then further supplemented by the by the significant increase in immigration, and that helped loosen a little bit of the tightness of the labor market at the lower income cohorts, either directly or indirectly. It's a little hard to tell exactly which, and you know, those lower income wage cohorts, which have high marginal propensity to spend, would have been, you know, wage growth at the lower end would have been even, you know, considerably higher had it not been for the significant immigration flow that we've seen. That's not a comment on whether that's a good idea or a bad idea from a political policy standpoint. That's just a diagnostic view from a macro practitioner perspective. And so, you know, I think the thing that's interesting about that is we basically have a situation where you have enough labor supply coming in, you know, with enough wage growth that's occurring, that you get basically a picture where we have, you know, nominal spending growth that's growing at about 6% a year. If you look at what the PCE report just published last week, it's basically what it shows: 6% earnings growth, you know, when you take wages and salaries. And then you've got 6% spending growth, you know, give or take nominal spending growth. And you put those things together, you know, a 6% nominal GDP growth in the economy is pretty good. You know, it's a pretty good situation, which you know, is very durable in terms of how it's being financed, because you don't have a bunch of debt growth. You have, you know, basically a combination of job growth and wage growth that's creating, you know, enough nominal incomes, that's creating enough nominal spending that, you know, we're continuing to, you know, plug along in a very sustainable way. I think the key question is, under that set of circumstances, can we actually get to an inflation rate that is, you know, durably at the Fed's mandate? You know, that's where I think probably, you know, Joseph and I disagree. You know, no problem. Reasonable people can disagree with each other all the time. Where I'm a little less concerned, I'm a little more concerned that that sort of circumstance sort of stabilizes us, given productivity and things like that, more in the 3% inflation range. Let's say 3 to 4% CPI range, rather than, you know, closer to 2. But you know, it's not necessarily clear that it's going to be, you know, it could or could not happen. But what it does look like is, unless something changes, we've got pretty good nominal GDP growth that's going to keep plugging along, in part supported by, you know, a pretty good flow of nominal wage growth, supported by a fair amount of labor force expansion.
Thank you, Bob. Martin, do you have anything to add to what Joseph or Bob said? Any disagreements there?
Well, no, I'll comment on immigration, because, you know, we're leading the world on immigration levels. Just to add some perspective, imagine this, guys. If the U.S. implemented the same kind of immigration policy Canada did, you would have had 12 million people last year in the U.S. I mean, that's just, it's crazy what's happening here in Canada. You know, we had, from the last 2 years, we had almost 3 million people, and we built 800,000 houses. So we're getting a wrecking ball of consequences from that. Immigration is fantastic, by the way, if you stage it in. I mean, if you look at the U.S. economy, you have 70% of it is driven by, you know, services, 18% goods, and 13% public sector. So you're seeing a lot of the inflation along the services side is baby boomer generations are saying, you know, wow, this is like, I almost died during COVID and I got locked up and I need to start spending some money. And Chipotle, I read that they have a steak bowl for $20 now. So if we can get those services costs down in the U.S. through immigration, and I agree with Bob, you know, that's certainly going to help things. In Canada, it's a whole different story, man. You got, like, if you want to talk about public sector, in the U.S. it's 13%. Canada, we're like 22, 23%. And public sector growth has increased by 40% in Canada since we elected this Trudeau government back in 2015. So, you know, it's things are way better off in the U.S. than what's happening here in Canada. And I really do think that's going to be supportive to I'm buying U.S. dollars is supportive to the currency. That may create a whole bunch of different challenges that fellow speakers here can comment on, but I certainly see a higher U.S. dollar and is continuing to play out from this, and U.S. attracting capital from an investment standpoint, as long as this nonsense is happening in Canada and Europe. We're going to get a rate cut in June, so Europe isn't looking that hot either.
Bob, I see your hand there.
Yeah, I got to press all the right buttons. I think one of the things that's interesting, Canada is a very interesting story. I mean, it's a market to trade, but I think it's also particularly interesting where it's highlighting the fact that immigration is obviously depressing, is creating a weight on wages because you have an increased supply of labor, but at the same time creating a tightness in essentially, you know, the fixed goods that are available in terms of housing, and that the inflationary pressures that ultimately result are a function of those two pressures happening at the same time. And I think the same thing in some ways can be looked at in the US case, where I think there has been very high expectations of a significant moderation in rental prices, which should bring the CPI numbers down, particularly the core CPI numbers, and give the Fed some confidence that we're getting back to 2%. And yet we're seeing signs in a number of different ways that maybe that rental inflation isn't moderating as fast as we were expecting. And it's very possible that the increase in labor supply is affecting that side. And so obviously it's, you know, the US is not getting 12 million people immigrating in the last year the way, you know, equivalent to what is experienced in Canada. But that trade-off between those two points, I think, is a very interesting dynamic that is actually more applicable to the U.S. story than maybe people necessarily recognize.
Well, I also just quickly add, so I dropped an image into the thread, following up on Bob's point, that in the not this most recent monetary policy report of the Bank of Canada, but the one before, they had a really interesting graph showing that the strong population growth through immigration has basically led rental prices to surge. And it's a really well done graph, and you can see it's really remarkable. And like Bob suggests, maybe the higher than expected or more persistent rental inflation that we see in the US may be in part due to our population growth as well.
Thank you all. So I want to kick this over to Les Baer with a follow-up here. In your recent publication, Macro Meta Multiples and Margins, you discuss at length the positive shifts noted in consumer finance and employment and wages, stating job gains remain solid while unemployment claims remain subdued. What does that strength in both labor and consumer finance say about the state of inflation to you, Les Baer?
Well, I think it ties on to what I was saying earlier in this discussion around sort of at least how I see the various data points, which is I guess there was two big macro concerns of mine that I've kind of written about over the past, let's say, 6 to 9 months that were sort of what I call nagging concerns, not things that changed my broader positive macroeconomic view, but things that I was just sort of following and watching pretty closely. So one of them was basically, or is, the labor market, and a lot of the stuff that we've talked about here with all the different reports that try to give you some indication about where that's going. And then the second one was on consumer finances, specifically looking at things like credit card delinquencies, auto loan delinquencies, et cetera, to have a view as to you know, whether those were getting worse or sort of moderating. And so for the past 2 years, both of those categories of macroeconomic signals have been getting worse, but from a very, very good starting position. So if you look at credit card delinquencies, those were as low as they've ever been maybe 2 years ago, and had been rising fairly rapidly over the past 2 years. And you could say basically the same thing about labor dynamics, except in sort of the opposite direction. They were about as tight as they've ever been 2 years ago, and they sort of had been cooling off you know, basically since rate hikes started maybe about 2 years ago. And so following those to see if there's an inflection point or whether they're going to continue to sort of accelerate to the downside and maybe lead into more of a recession has been something that I've, you know, been following. But I would say that on both fronts, so on the consumer finances front, what we've seen from a lot of especially like subprime credit card providers like Discover and Capital One earlier this year was that they actually thought that delinquencies were going to plateau earlier than what a lot of analysts were expecting. And they saw a lot of that being sort of a seasoning of the sort of massive credit expansion that occurred in sort of 2021, 2022. And naturally, delinquencies sort of expand over the term of sort of extending that credit. So a lot of that increase in delinquency rates was likely due to not so much a horrible deterioration in people's finances, but sort of a natural seasoning of that credit over time. And we sure enough have seen that both in a lot of the sort of, let's say, consumer credit focused companies that have released reports, including Discover, which was down, which showed the first sort of decline in delinquency data on a quarterly basis in, I think, 8 quarters. And so I think I view that obviously as a positive sign macroeconomically. And I think it also ties into the labor dynamics, which, again, I've seen. I mean, it's hard to say that there's a massive inflection upwards or reacceleration, but I think when you're looking at these long-term macroeconomic trend lines, it's really important to catch the inflection points early rather than sort of wait for them to become quite obvious if you're going to take any sort of value from them. So from my perspective, I think that there's enough positive news on the labor acceleration front, let's say in the past several months, that I think the two of those both sort of support my view that the macroeconomic condition is quite strong.
Does anyone have any comments to what Last Bear said before I have before I move us along here, Joseph or Martin?
Well, I'll make one comment on the rise in credit card and auto delinquencies. So I was looking at this, and I know many people on Twitter have been pointing to something like this as an indicator of weakening consumers. But I also had a conversation with Warren Mosler, who has some experience in these matters, and he made a really interesting point in that sometimes this is not necessarily saying that the credit quality is diminished, but it could also just be a reflection of the risk appetite of the commercial banks or the credit card companies. For example, if you're a credit card company, you always know that you're going to have some defaults, right? So you make a calculation, how much can you make, what are your expected defaults, and you go for it. Now, what could also have been happening is that the spreads on credit card loans, as we all know, credit card interest rates, auto loan interest rates are really high, such that even after taking into account defaults, the companies are willing to make these loans. So rather than say that these rising defaults is an indicator of deteriorating credit quality, it could also just be a reflection of higher risk appetite from these finance companies, given that the spreads that they can earn are so much higher today.
I think that's outstanding. Like what Joseph just walked you through is the type of thinking that we have to do is instead of looking at the top line data, start asking yourself why and start you know, digging and going into that so that it'll help derive the bigger picture as to the consequences. So, Joseph, thanks. That was awesome.
So it kind of does bring me around to the topic of credit in general. So I want to touch on that a little bit. And then I do want to come back to that overarching topic of inflation as a whole. But one concern I wanted to ask the panel as a whole about is that of commercial real estate. For example, in the month of April, Bloomberg reported that 43% of small businesses were unable to pay their rent in full for April due to economic headwinds. And numerous companies have also sold their commercial real estate for massive losses, such as, you know, Blackstone's $420 million loss on the famed Mony property that they sold earlier this week, I think it was. What connotations, if any, really, does this carry moving forward? Should we be concerned at all about commercial real estate, or will the average person be largely unaffected? Let's start here with Joseph and then kick it around the panel.
So commercial real estate, as we all know, have just been in the headlines for a lot. So I think we have to have, you know, commercial real estate is a very large category within it. You have hospitals, you have data centers, you have industrial space, and you also have office spaces. So as we all know, the office space, particularly in certain downtown areas, has not done well. And the retail space in those areas that depend upon office workers have also not done that well. But I think if you look at it on a system-wide basis, it doesn't seem to be that big of a deal. Now, the FDIC does these really good quarterly reports on the banking sector. And when you look at their graphs, you can get the picture, actually, and I'll post it in the thread as well, that the commercial real estate sector is just, you know, it's some parts of it are not good, but it's just kind of a small part of the entire financial system. So I don't think it's something that I worry about. And secondly, from what I hear from Fed speakers, it's not something they worry about either. Their thinking for Governor Waller is that this is something that everyone knows. We've had a lot of time to negotiate, to settle, to work through. So it's not these very known knowns that tend to trip you up. So I'm not very worried about this.
Fair enough. Bob, any thoughts to that? Are you concerned, or are you just kind of vibing with it like Joseph?
I'm not particularly concerned, which, you know, a year ago, a lot of people thought I was a crazy person by having that take. But, you know, I think the reality is that commercial real estate is almost all of the loans are on balance sheet, are on banks' balance sheets, and you know, have relatively low LTVs. And so I think what we're seeing is there's some people who are losing on the equity side of things. But the question is, you know, what's the impact on the banking system? Because that's really the systemic risk. Like, look, if some pension funds lose some money on some sparkly office buildings in Midtown Manhattan, it doesn't matter. That makes no difference to financial stability or economic growth. What matters is if the banks get impaired as a function of this stuff. And so that's the thing that I'm really focused on and thinking about, is, you know, how much impairment is occurring. And when I'm looking at that, what I'm saying is, you know, the fourth quarter, you know, FDIC number, 24 basis points of charge-offs related to commercial real estate. And I think you could, and I'll put this in there, back in last March, I did analysis on saying, what if you had, you know, commercial real estate losses that were something like 2x that of what happened in the Depression? There's more than enough earnings potential, as well as capital in these banks to be able to absorb those. And the reality is, you know, I sort of often joke, bankers, you know, one thing that bankers are good at is not making good loans. They're darn good at not recognizing bad ones. And so the reality is that the term of these things are somewhere between 5 and 10 years, the loans, you know, tack on an extra, you know, 24 to 48 months of pretending. And, you know, this is going to be recognized, you know, 5 years from now will be the median point of this problem being recognized. And 5 years from now, we'll be talking about something else.
Thank you, Bob. And that actually, that brings me directly to that topic of office loans, because Fitch Ratings estimates that 3/4 of U.S. conduit office loans will default through 2024. So 3/4 is quite a bit, it seems to me. And if we have such a landslide of loan defaults like that, what does that mean for commercial real estate? And what effects could we see on the economy as a result? Martin, what are your thoughts?
I'm out of the sector. So, I mean, there was a big push to invest in that segment, especially in the U.S., seeking out investors. And they tend to come up to Canada when they run out of interest south of the border. And fortunately, we recognize that pattern. So we've been out of it. And but you're having a similar situation here in Canada as well, too. And so it's going to have to get worked through. And what's really interesting is the dichotomy between public market and private market, and the write downs that we're going to have to see among the private side. So it's something that isn't keeping me awake at night, because I'm not participating in the sector. But in regards to the flow through as to the U.S. economy, I'll leave that to the three others here who I'd probably have a much more better take on it than I would.
I am just struggling with the microphone today. Sorry for the silence there for a moment, folks. I think that's fair enough, Martin. So I do just kind of want to pivot here. We got about 13 minutes until we get some numbers, but I kind of want to go back just to that concept of real estate as a whole. In the arena of residential real estate, there's still some concerns as well. For example, the median cost to buy a home just continues to surge, it seems. And while the 30-year mortgage rates are also holding firmly above that 7%, the concerns of affordability for the average American is pretty high. And, you know, despite the number of owners that have been sitting on their mortgages has been dropping, so less people are sitting on those low mortgage rates than they were, you know, say half a year ago. Last bear, I know I always kind of pick on you about housing on these, but what are your thoughts here? Is residential facing some of those similar risks that commercial has been?
Well, I would say that in a similar way to the fact that you had to segment commercial real estate, I think it's important to segment residential real estate as well. Obviously, location, location, location. So that can be a good thing or a bad thing. I think that you do see some amount of, I think the story is very different depending on where you look in the country. And I think broadly based, what we still see is that despite the surge in mortgage rates, despite the affordability crunch, which I think no one is doubting, that real estate prices have held firm throughout much of the country, including sort of the Northeast, Midwest. Probably it has done the worst, and maybe some of the Sun Belt and West Coast markets, but those are also markets that saw the biggest appreciation overall. So I think that you can look at, like, there's, I look at inventory data by sort of MSAs or, you know, city areas, broadly speaking. And so you see inventory coming back pretty much across the board to be at a more normalized level, but I haven't found really any area that you see inventory that's sort of surging and ready to exceed sort of the pre-COVID level. And if you look at things like vacancies and other sort of measures of sort of housing supply versus demand, they're still very tight. And obviously the data that we're seeing, despite all the affordability concerns, clearly shows that housing prices on average across the US are not going down. So whether there's still sort of a normalization that's coming through, I think it remains to be seen. I think it's most likely that if there are declines in real estate prices, they'll be localized to areas that saw more significant appreciation, and which also perhaps were beneficiaries of sort of changes in location around COVID, or people, you know, moving down to Florida or that sort of thing, maybe normalizing to some degree. But broadly speaking, it's tough to argue with the data that real estate is holding in much better than people assume. So it does. I at the same time, I also don't really understand how that works entirely. I mean, speaking in New York, for example, you know, the cost to own, let's say, the apartment that I currently rent would be about twice what it costs to rent it right now. So I don't know how that sustains over the long term, but for the time being, it's holding up.
I'll Can I jump in here?
Please, yeah.
Okay, you want to talk about housing? We'll talk about housing.
Minute, Martin.
Yeah. Oh man, I mean, you guys have it good down there, really good. I'm almost tempted to drop the F-bomb here because it is a complete shit show in Canada, a complete shit show. The average housing price in the U.S. is 6 times median income, up from 4 to 5 times 2 decades ago. In Canada, we're running 13 times, and we're not even close. And then if you look at taxation, so for example, TD did a report showing that the average income in Canada to qualify for the average home purchase is $200,000 Canadian. Now, for perspective, the highest tax bracket in Canada, we consider super wealthy, is $240,000. So that's what I mean by being a complete shit show. And so, if we need to take a look at some of the bigger picture here, the U.S. is the productivity is significantly better than in Canada. Our GDP per capita is negative. It's been negative for 18 consecutive months. So our economy is shrinking, and wages and incomes are going lower, and housing prices is going higher. And that's the situation that creates chaos. And in the U.S., you have productivity, you have growth, you have rising incomes. And sure, housing prices are a little stickier, but you're seeing an improvement. You're looking at jurisdictions like San Francisco and other areas that you're seeing prices fall to make it a little bit more affordable in those places, although, you know, taxes certainly are driving individuals to other states like Florida. But the bottom line is that the U.S. is in really good shape from a housing perspective. All you have to do is compare and contrast to what's happening north of the border.
Thank you, Martin. So I kind of want to pivot us back here to what we were talking about earlier, very briefly on credit. We got about 8 minutes till we get the release and about 38 minutes until the Jay Powell presser. So I want to touch again here before we get some numbers on that topic of consumer credit. It was briefly mentioned, I think it was Joseph that mentioned it earlier, about credit balances and defaults in the consumer sector. But nominal credit card balances set a new series high, and card utilization also rose as consumers kind of stretched their credit lines further and further as we get deeper into 2024 here, while unpaid balances continue to rise. How concerned should we be about this, if at all? Will there be a credit event like some, such as Michael Guyad, have called for? Let's start with Joseph, and then I want to kick this one around the panel.
So as you correctly know, credit card balances have risen, but we have to keep that in context. But everything has risen. Like, we have tremendous amounts of inflation over the past few years. Now, defaults have risen, and as we discussed earlier, part of that could be in part simply due to the fact that some companies have more risk appetite, so they're making more loans to people who they know they can't pay them back. But because the spreads are so wide, that they're willing to take that risk. More broadly speaking, some of the more market-based indicators of credit quality would be credit spreads, and they're really narrow, and you can't really see any concern from that at all. One of the reasons why credit spreads could be narrow is that some people speculate it could be the rise of companies like private credit funds who are very aggressive in lending. And if you are very aggressive in lending, then I think it's less likely to default because a company could always roll things over. Now, the most recent financial stability report by the Fed, put out just a couple of weeks ago, has an interesting graph on the interest coverage ratios of companies. And it looks like it's in line with how it's been over the past few years. Again, interest rates have come up a lot. The interest credit coverage ratio was a lot higher earlier, but right now it's in line with how it's been historically. So it doesn't seem, at least from my read, that there is any meaningful credit risk right now in the broader system.
Thank you, Joseph. Bob, what are your thoughts on the credit situation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not typically an anecdotal kind of guy, as probably most of you know who follow me, but I have been struck by the number of people that I know who basically have said to me some form of, I'm running a good business, but I've got too much debt and too much interest payments as a function of that. And if I could just not pay as much interest or not have as much debt, this would be a great business. Which on its surface is kind of funny just to hear that. But I think, and you know, those are mostly, you know, private credit or private equity financed businesses. And I think it highlights an area of the market where, you know, there's a lot of, there's cracks under the surface where decent businesses were levered up in order to consolidate them and, you know, basically get higher returns on equity, but where earnings growth, EBITDA growth hasn't been nearly as good as expected, and interest rates have been a lot higher for a lot longer than people expected, and you put that together. And many of those companies, they can kind of get by, you know, on a cash flow basis by being able to create, you know, just enough EBITDA to be able to pay off their running interest, but nothing close to what's necessary to pay off the amount of debt that has existed in the end. And so they either need to get a total restructuring of the debt, or, you know, they're going to run, you know, if there's any hiccup, or they're not going to pay back the level of debt. And then from a cash flow perspective, if there's any hiccup in the earnings side of things, they're so close. They're so finely tuned to basically earning just enough to pay off the debt service, the running debt service, that if interest rates for whatever reason were to go up, or, you know, earnings were to moderate even to a modest extent, they can very quickly tip into, you know, cash flow negative situations that are would be very challenging to persist in. And so while I agree with the sort of general idea, particularly amongst public market companies, that, you know, debt service coverage is pretty good, and leverage in, you know, publicly traded companies, you know, even the high yield bond market are pretty good. The nexus of problems are going to be in this private equity and private credit area. And that's an area that, you know, 10 years ago mostly didn't matter too much. And today, you know, the private credit side of things, it's like a third bigger than the high yield bond market. So, you know, it's substantial in size, and very few people really understand exactly what's going on in there.
Thank you, Bob. So I actually, Joseph, we got 2 minutes here before we get some numbers, and then I want to let everybody kind of take a moment to mull things over before we continue. But I wanted to kind of just play a little devil's advocate to something you had said. You mentioned that, yeah, the unpaid balances are rising, but so is everything else. My follow-up to that would be credit card interest rates are also rising. They're actually, you know, consistently hitting all-time highs. And so my question there is, does that add any point of concern that both unpaid balances and the interest rates on lines of credit are rising?
So definitely there is some part of the population that is struggling because of higher interest rates. So that's pretty clear. And I think in some of the earnings reports, you also have commentary from management suggesting that some consumers are struggling. So that's definitely something we want to keep in mind. But I just don't think it's systemic in the sense that it affects the broader financial system. But it is something of concern, and that's something we should take note of going forward.
Thank you. So we've got a little less than a minute before we get some numbers. Last Sparrow, Martin, did you have anything you wanted to add to the credit conversation while we wait for the drop?
Yeah, I'll pull something on here. High yield bonds and investment grade bonds are up 8 to 10% since October. High yield bonds the yields are down to 6%. I don't think it's reflecting the risk that you're taking on to get a spread there. So I'd be liquidating, and we have been. Any sort of exposure on those gains.
Good deal. We are right at the time. I'm going to give it just a minute. It looks like rates remain unchanged, which I imagine comes as no surprise to anyone at this point. So bear with us for a few moments while we give folks a little bit of time to look over the drop. And then I'll probably start bugging Joseph about the dot plots.
Right off the bat, I think that one dovish surprise is that the QT cap, people were expecting it to go from $60 billion to $30 billion for treasuries. It's going to $25 billion. So that is some support for the bond market.
Yeah, I agree. They've telegraphed QT taper for a while now, but 60 to 25 billion is really substantial. Obviously, it cuts the Treasury QT more than half, which, as folks may know, the mortgage-backed security side isn't changing, but it's also running well below sort of its cap level. So total QT is going to go from like 70 billion a month currently at an effective rate to like probably like 40, 35, 40. So it's pretty significant.
Any other preliminary comments on what you guys are seeing?
Obviously, they're at the top. Certainly a change in tone in terms of the ability to meet the inflation objective, which, you know, it's kind of weird that your incremental changes would be recognizing that there's a lack of progress towards the Fed's mandate and at the same time engaging in a relatively substantive easing by slowing the pace of QT. Like, you know, I know folks at the Fed see it differently, but like if they're actually concerned about inflation, like cutting down on QT is just like it's totally counterproductive. It's a totally counterproductive approach to monetary policy. And in particular, because the short rate is so ineffective at creating a necessary tightening to slow down the economy, which we've seen for the last 18 months. So the thing that is going to create the slowing is what happens on the long end. And how the long end flows through to both borrowing activities as well as to asset prices, the discount rate to asset prices. And so they're working against themselves right here.
Hey, Bob, what is that sending as a message to market participants in regards to cutting their treasury redemption cap?
Well, I think as was said before, I think most people expected them to cut the pace of QT, and so in like it's a marginally greater slowing of QT than was expected. Get that all right, all those directions right. But I think it's pretty marginal in the scheme of things. So in that sense, this is not a particularly substantial surprise in one direction or another, and the markets are largely operating consistent with that in terms of not moving that much on this news. So I was talking more about the sort of general point of like weird choice, and I think a counterproductive choice for them to go down this path the way that they are.
I would also add, and I agree completely with Bob. So I remember when they were tightening monetary policy, Chair Powell and the team would just go and say, yeah, we're raising interest rates. And not just that, we're shrinking the balance sheet, right? Look at this. But in their most recent minutes, they were very, very strong to emphasize that although they are slowing the pace of QT, they are definitely, definitely not changing the stance of monetary policy. But you can't have it both ways. When you're tightening, you can't claim that, you know, QT is tightening. But then when you slow QT down, you can't say that you're actually not easing. That doesn't make any sense. And this is definitely not not helpful. But one other way that I'm thinking about this is, obviously the Treasury did not cut their coupon sizes. I'm not sure why anyone thought they would. They were quite clear that they wouldn't. But the Fed, by, you know, maybe slowing down QT even more than expected, kind of does this for them.
Yeah, I think I agree with what folks have outlined, that it's a kind of confusing statement where they're both more hawkish on the federal funds rate and also marginally more dovish, but confirming the the QT reduction. But I do think if you think about it, it's not, I mean, the impact of the QT taper is significant. So if you think about a $30 billion monthly reduction in treasuries, that amounts to, over the course of a year, $360 billion less of treasury issuance. And basically the way that QT gets funded is by the treasury issuing, you know, more debt. So that's a direct offset between the needs of the treasury, or sort of the flexibility of the treasury, versus the stance of monetary policy and inflation overall. And I think that for folks who are who consider the fiscal dominance arguments in a lot of the macroeconomic circumstances today, which I think are fairly valid, I think this is certainly fodder for those perspectives, that this is basically accommodation of the treasury and despite what is a more troubling inflation environment.
So let's continue down this line a little bit more, because I do see that the 10-year at least is up a little bit following the report. And I do want to touch really quickly on yields. So earlier, the 10-year popped above 4.7%. And according to Goldman Sachs, once the 10-year treasury hits 5%, the correlation between bond yields and stocks turns negative. And at that point, will spoil entirely the 2024 stock rally. So I'm curious now, since we're on the topic, is this accurate? Will rising yields cause mayhem in equities? Let's start with Bob here and then kick her around.
Mayhem, I like that. I'm thinking of that commercial where the mayhem guy is doing all sorts of crazy stuff. You give him like a bond market t-shirt for the financial markets. The basic story, you know, bond yields rose a fair amount in the first quarter of the year, and stocks could continue to rise. And I think, you know, a big part of that was that we entered the year where growth expectations were actually quite soft, and earnings expectations were relatively depressed. And so as we had a period where equity investors recognized that, you know, growth was likely to be stronger than what was originally expected, you could have a circumstance where both stock prices rise and bond yields rise at the same time. And I think the trouble is, and really sort of where we were by the first part of April, was that the expectations for growth in the U.S. economy for 2024 were back up to, I don't know, 2.5%, let's say. And 2.5% is pretty high. You know, not impossible, but, you know, so that's a pretty good growth rate to expect over the course of the year. And I think the challenge, and we had earnings growth expectations that had gotten to something like 18% year over year expected by fourth quarter this year. And so those are pretty high expectations. And so I think the challenge is, given those expectations are so high and they're already reflected in the price, that the incremental effect of bond yield rises and the discount rate effect plus the slowing of economic conditions as a function of those higher bond yields almost directly goes into the price action of the stocks, because the expectations of growth probably can't increase too much more. And so that's sort of like the fundamental interplay, which is creating this sort of effect, which basically looks like, now that bond yields have gone above, I don't know, 4.5, let's say, it's when this transition happened, it looks like all of a sudden bond yields are now affecting, you know, stock prices in a way that they didn't before. But it's really that interplay of expectations with the level of rates that's causing the interplay that we're seeing, you know, at this point.
Thank you, Bob. Does anyone have anything to add to Bob's comments?
I think you.
I'll jump in. So first of all, the stock market is not always the economy, as we've seen the last couple of years. If you look at the S&P 500, of those 500 companies, they represent only 18% of the total U.S. employment, which is fascinating. And it was a stat put up by Piker Capital I saw earlier today. And it really got me thinking about that and the makeup of the S&P. Goldman Sachs came out saying that, you know, you're probably better to huddle within the big megas within the S&P, because they're a little bit more resilient in regards to sensitivity to what's happening in the bond market than other segments, which could partially have some truth to it. But that's assuming past performance equates to future performance, and that's been a very dangerous path to go down. And so I'm looking at it from our clients' portfolios as a means of the last month and a half of just hedging. It's been a heck of a run here, and who knows if that correlation will kick in or turn negative or in regards to that magic number of, is it 5%? I don't know. So hedging your equity market exposure and not doing so through bonds is a unique approach that's been very successful for us, and other portfolio managers are going back to doing the bond trade versus the equity trade. We're just trying to stay out of that altogether.
Joseph and Les Bear, I saw that you guys were going to comment as well.
I would just make a quick observation that over the past decade, you know, the 10-year hasn't been at 5% too much. I think we were at 5%. You know, at the end of last year, and the equity market didn't like it. So maybe their study was based on that one observation. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment to some degree. I also think that a lot from the equity market perspective, you could argue that rates have already had some impact maybe on easing the rally a little bit, as we've seen rates go up by about 75, almost 100 basis points since the start of the year on the 10-year, let's say. But I also think that in the equity market, what we've seen since basically the end of October was a massive momentum rally where, I mean, you can pick your name of different sort of categories of assets, whether it's crypto or semiconductors or, you know, consumer discretionary, like practically any stock that has some sort of, or asset that has some sort of subjectivity to it or that has a good theme behind it has, you know, appreciated quite substantially. And so I do think that there's sort of a momentum trade that got a little bit out of our skis that's resetting right now. And that's kind of happening maybe somewhat related to rates, maybe somewhat unrelated to rates. But I do think that those just like broad sentiment indicators are important as well.
So with about 18 minutes until the presser, I want to touch on commodities as well as intersection with treasuries, and we'll get to that after this first question here on commodities, but I want to touch on gold specifically for a moment. Now, it's obviously no secret at all that gold has been climbing and climbing, hitting new highs after new highs, and this does concern some, especially, you know, in the realm of equities. Joseph, you actually recently said with gold still surging, it's kind of concerning. What are those concerns that you're referring to with the surging gold price? And is this a foreshadowing for market downside or a hit to the economy, Joseph?
No, I don't think so. So gold has been surging as well. And Bob has done some really good threads as to why gold is a valuable part of your portfolio. Well, the way that I look at what's happening is that, well, traditionally, if you are a, you know, standard macro investor, you look at gold as a function of, say, real rates or maybe dollar strength and stuff like that. But the dollar has been strong. Real rates have been high. And so you see gold surging. You can look at the asset net asset values of GLD, a popular retail investment vehicle for gold. And, you know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of retail excitement. What really seems to be driving gold, now, part of it was geopolitics, as we saw earlier, but even with that seemingly fading away, gold is still pretty strong. It seems to be, I think, some greater geopolitical forces at play, that maybe you have some large sovereign investors who are, for good reason, diversifying their foreign reserves, maybe just a little bit out of their dollar holdings and into things like gold. So another way that I like to think of it is, why is the U.S. building all these chip factories in Texas and Arizona and so forth? They're trying to diversify their supply chains and being less reliant upon other countries. The flip side to that, for say a large country like China, who, you know, doesn't really import that much stuff from the US, would be their reliance on the US financial system, and that could be buying gold. Now, I think this could be concerning going forward. It's because a lot of the things that keep, that prevent large-scale geopolitical conflict is just mutual dependence between countries. Now, when you cut that dependence away, let's say that I don't trade as much with you and I am not reliant upon your financial system, then there's a lot less at stake when you actually go into hot conflicts. That being said, you know, if you have a large pool of capital, maybe not just China. I'm sure many, many other countries in the world are thinking about this. After all, we did have one presidential campaign tell you that they would like to devalue the dollar. You could have this standing bid that has nothing to do with, you know, macro and so forth, but everything to do with just prudent risk management for a sovereign manager. So I think that's an interesting development that's happening in markets, and that is beyond standard macro, but more of a political dimension. That makes sense to me personally.
Thank you, Joseph. Does anyone have any comments?
The only thing I add on the gold story, I think Joseph's point about global central banks, particularly, let's say, in countries that have expressed being adverse to the United States, buying gold has been an important structural support. It's interesting that the more tactical support dynamics, look really not to be related to anything to do with the U.S. Dollar specifically. Like, U.S. investors are not going in and, basically not buying gold-based ETFs, which is a common way in which they invest in it, really at all for the last 2 years, including during this period of the run-up. And what you're actually seeing is quite a significant demand in China in particular, I think in part because there's a pressure on that exchange rate. There's a desire to hold alternative assets, maybe outside the banking system, and traditional ways to channel money, either through getting it out of the country via, into dollars and foreign banks, is becoming more challenging. Real estate is obviously not as good an investment. Stocks are falling. And so people are really drawn towards essentially the oldest storehold of wealth that has ever existed, which is gold. And so we've seen a surge in imports of gold into China over the last couple of months. We've seen the Shanghai gold premium trade at a significantly elevated levels. We've seen gold-based ETFs in China trade at 30% premiums, which is obviously crazy, but indicative of the demand. And so I think that constellation of things really, and then we've actually seen the weakness in gold in the last couple of days, not today, but the previous 2 days of this week, connected to some more elevated margin requirements in the Shanghai trading on the Shanghai futures market. And so all of that points to the fact that, a lot of this sort of immediate upward pressure in gold looks like it's connected to the Chinese situation. The real question is whether Western investors get involved in buying gold. Even if they just went from the stopping their selling to neutral, it would be a big positive demand impulse on the gold market.
So, Bob, you actually, just to continue down this vein of gold, pun intended, you gave me a pretty perfect segue here, you and Joseph both, to how I wanted to tie gold into treasury holdings. So you both brought up China, which obviously is super hot topic there. The way they've been onboarding their gold reserves seems to be pretty rampant, I think. Rampant may be maybe not the best word, maybe more a little aggressive. But we're also seeing a pretty dramatic reduction in U.S. Treasury holdings by China and some other countries internationally as well. And this seems to have been the case for a while now, while China's gold holdings continue to increase. So I'm curious to the whole panel, and anyone feel free to start here, what are you seeing elsewhere? And are there any, long-term negative connotations to foreign governments lessening their U.S. Treasury holdings in favor of gold, for example, like China's doing?
Well, I think for the past maybe 20, 25 years, the U.S. has increasingly used its currency strategically, let's say, both, for economic purposes, but also increasingly in lieu of, direct military conflict or things through sanctions or seizure of assets, obviously in the case of Russia. And so that simultaneously can be an effective use of policy to the extent that there isn't a lot of alternatives. But over time, I think that there is limits to how much you can push that without it, without people at least seeking an alternative. But I do think that the story around China is really important for gold right now, especially just sort of the macroeconomic conditions in China. Obviously, they've gone through probably the worst macroeconomic conditions of any major economy over the past 2 years, largely driven, in my opinion, by the real estate market that has sort of totally crashed over the past 2 years. That was the largest store of the average person's wealth. That was where people put their money. So it could be, like I think Bob mentioned, sort of a reallocation. You know, there aren't actually a ton of alternatives, which is part of the reason why real estate had gotten so hot. But I do think that the geopolitical pressures combined with sort of a maybe slightly improving Chinese economy and desire to hold a different sort of wealth is definitely adding fuel to the fire.
Thank you, Les Bear. Any other comments on that?
I think the biggest thing when you know, the global central banks hold, I don't know, $3-4 trillion of U.S. Treasuries, something in that order of magnitude, and it just, and then you know some amount of agencies and stocks and other things, you know it just doesn't take that much demand, nominal demand, to squeeze the gold market higher. You know, even before this year. You know, the global central banks represented something like between, you know, a third and half of annual mine supply. Their annual purchases were a third to a half of annual mine supply. You know, if that, it doesn't take much more demand to start to basically eat up that incremental supply. And the thing that's interesting about the gold market, we won't make this a long conversation about the gold market, but there's some interesting nuances about the gold market. In particular, once you basically start to buy up all the mine supply, you know, you start to it can become increasingly difficult to bring supply to the market, since a lot of gold that's in above ground stocks, say monetary gold, is, you know, is being held for the long term. So it takes a real effort in terms of price action to cause those sales to exist. Stuff sitting in lockers, you know, in Switzerland, et cetera. Or if you think about scrap, which is typically how the market gets cleared when there's a lot of demand, you know, what's it going to take to start to get ads back on the television saying, you know, sell your gold for cash now. You know, it's tough to get enough mine supply or enough scrap supply into the market if there's a lot of demand. So it's a tight market that doesn't take a whole lot of incremental demand to create real price increases, you know, whether they're coming from geopolitical or central banks or, you know, currency savings from folks in Asia.
I just posted a chart on to, that'll show a picture of what Bob's saying on demand. It's massive. It's like gold trading volume in China is 400% larger than the average seen in from last year. So, you know, there's something going on.
So what I want to do here, we've got about 6 minutes until the Jerome Powell presser. I kind of just want to go around the panel, each person in turn, and just kind of give any overarching or, you know, closing thoughts that you might have in mind or something we didn't get to touch on enough that you have comments on. And of course, feel free to plug anything. For those of you tuning in, we'll be playing the presser here in about 5 minutes now. But I do want to go around the panel and just get some final thoughts on any of the topics we discussed. Les start off here with Les Bear. And again, feel free to plug anything you have coming out, anything you're working on. The folks will love to hear it.
So I think I will say, just in respect to this, we'll see what Powell says at the presser. Obviously, that sometimes matters more than the statement. But the statement is kind of an odd mixed bag, as we discussed. And I think that increasingly we're going to continue to hear talk about the relationship between fiscal and monetary policy and the arguments around fiscal dominance. This sort of ties right into that. More broadly speaking, I would say with respect to the markets, which I'm sure a lot of people care about, again, I just wanted to emphasize sort of the point around the momentum trade that has sort of broken down, and we haven't seen a lot of support coming back in for that. So I just issue a word of caution on that. And then I guess just to follow me, if you like what I say here, you can read my thoughts on Substack every Friday morning. I publish, so you can find that on my Twitter account. And thanks guys for having me. It's always a great time.
Always a great time having you, Last Bear. Bob, any closing thoughts? Anything you wanted to comment on or anything you need to plug?
Thanks for having me. This is, I consistently find these conversations some of the most interesting, that I can do. And it's neat that we can essentially share it out there in the public, with everyone. So it's, I really enjoy it. So thank you for having me. I think, I wrote about it a little bit this morning, but I think what's going to really matter in terms of, asset prices and how this economy unfolds is how the long end moves. And so it'll be, given the policy shifts that occurred today related to the slowing of QT, it'll be interesting to see, how the supply demand works out in the long end of the bond market, because that's going to determine whether or not this cycle turns at this point. If people like to follow what I'm doing, I'm on Twitter, as you all know. Check it out. I also do YouTube and write about sort of the financial economy industry, the financial industry over on LinkedIn as well. So definitely check any of that stuff out.
Definitely check it out, folks. I do like, especially, I check in on yours and Joseph's YouTubes pretty frequently. I check in on Last Bear's Substack pretty frequently, and I just endless learning for me. I'm not the biggest market brain in the world, so pretty invaluable information from all of you for sure. Martin, thanks for joining us today. Anything you wanted to add here at the tail end before we get to the presser?
Yeah, so I'm really grateful to be able to connect and get access to the data points and the really true objective analysis of that data from Last Bear, Bob, and Joseph. You guys are truly awesome. My job is to take all of that data, and there's a pile of it, and condense it into something that's actionable and actionable for our investors and who we're looking after. And so when I'm looking at today's market, and looking at the macro and all of this data that's been shared, and condensing it down into some actionable items, three main points I'll leave you with, and they all tie into buying insurance when it's cheap. Bonds are not cheap and not without risk, and so be aware of that. Commodities are cheap in certain areas like oil. We didn't talk much about oil, but it's selling off today. Great opportunity to add some low-cost protection into your portfolio. Gold is expensive. You may want to take some of that profit from gold and deploy it into the energy sector. In Canada, if you're looking at energy, Canadian energy companies, TMX opened up today. We're increasing throughput. We're sending oil over to India, to the largest refinery, and we get paid in U.S. dollars. And you can buy these Canadian companies for Canadian dollars, which I just told you earlier in this conversation that it's going lower. And then finally, Last Bear mentioned that there's a lot of momentum in the market. I totally agree. Options, look at options. Calls are very expensive. Good time to sell some calls. Puts are very inexpensive. Good time to buy some puts. So there you go. Three ideas to leave you with. If you want to follow me, I'm on X. I also send out a monthly strategic piece, which is free. Who doesn't like free research? I talk about our strategies and our secret sauce.
Thank you, Martin. And again, thank you for joining us today. You were really great to have on. This was a really smooth panel. Joseph, anything you want to add here before we kick him over to the presser?
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me. I love these panels. I learned so much. All of you guys have to follow everyone here, including our great moderator, Nicholas, and of course, Unusual Wells. So after this FOMC, I will put on a video on my YouTube channel, Joseph Wang, where I will give you my thoughts, basically an FOMC debrief. So tune in to hear my thoughts if you're interested.
Absolutely do that, folks. We're going to kick over to the presser now. We'll be playing audio here and the video itself at twitch.tv/unusualwales. Make sure you're paying attention to all the speakers we've had today. Our panelists always have great information. They're always keeping people updated and valuable information from every single one of them.